He was one of Hollywood's up-and-coming screenwriters. But in 1928, he had a vision that changed his life forever and led him on the road to becoming one of the United States' leading fascist leaders. William Dudley Pelley would later brag that he was the first American to advocate a form of Nazism for the United States. Pelley was open about his ambitions to create a dictatorship right here in the U.S., and he told his followers to start stockpiling weapons to make that vision a reality. This is Star Spangled Fascism, The Chief and the Legion, Part 1.
There's a reason he gets called the Star Spangled Fascist sometimes, because he was very patriotic in his own strange way.
I'm historian Bradley W. Hart, author of the award-winning book, Hitler's American Friends. In this podcast, we're examining fascist leaders and movements that have emerged here in the United States over the past century. We'll look at what fueled their authoritarian ambitions, the supporters who flocked to them, and the Americans who stood in their way. In this episode, we'll be exploring the strange but dangerous founder of an American-born fascist group willing to take up arms to overthrow the U.S. government to make himself a fascist-style dictator. And this entire idea was driven by a mystical vision that William Dudley Pelley reported having back one night in 1928, a vision, he claimed, of the great beyond. William Dudley Pelley is quite frankly one of the stranger figures I encountered in all of my research. At various times, he seemed to have every job imaginable. He was a fiction writer, then he became a journalist, then he was a publisher, and then he became a Hollywood screenwriter. But his next move was much less popular. In 1933, he declared himself to be the leader of a new political movement based on Adolf Hitler's Nazi Party. He wanted to make himself the Hitler-style dictator of the U.S., and he claimed that his new contacts in the spirit world were behind his new venture. My guest on the podcast is Scott Beekman, the chair of the School of Liberal Arts, professor of history at the University of Rio Grande in Ohio. You are the author of the biography of William Dudley Pelley, entitled William Dudley Pelley, A Life in Right-Wing Extremism and the Occult. An absolutely fantastic book that's been very helpful for me. So congratulations on that, Scott.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining the conversation about Pelley. I think this is a figure that, quite frankly, most listeners to the podcast have probably never heard of before. By background, Pelley is born in Lynn, Massachusetts. He comes from this very WASPy, I think we might say, family background. His father, he's a manager at a shoe factory, but that doesn't seem to be what Pelley's father is after, because in fact, he is studying theology at night. Faith is very important to him. So he moves from being a sort of factory foreman into being a Methodist minister. So the young William Dudley Pelley, somewhat surprisingly, I think, based upon how his career unfolds, grows up in this household where very traditional Protestantism is deeply important. What did you find are the young William Dudley Pelley's views on religion? What's it like growing up in this household, and what does he himself believe?
Sure. You know, he was a fairly Orthodox Methodist as a young man. And one of the things that's interesting about Pelley is you really can see the heavy influence of his father on his subsequent career. His father was a minister. Pelley could roughly be defined as a minister. His father was a newspaperman for a while. Pelley becomes a newspaperman and a writer. And I think what most of what he contributes to his later career is a very sort of conservative traditional value system that is rooted in concerns about the changes in American society in the late 19th, early 20th century, particularly in an area like New England, where there's a massive influx of the new immigrants. And so Pelley, he always claimed to be a Christian. And for his entire career, he always said he was a Christian. It's just that Christianity had been perverted, and in his eyes, it was always perverted by the Jews. I think those values never leave him, and I think they're instilled very early on, and they carry him through really his entire life.
You mentioned the changes in 19th century American society, especially the influx of immigration, that we forget that the debates over immigration have gone on as long as the country has existed effectively. And the immigrants that people like Pelley are panicking about in the 19th century are Irish Americans,
yes,
largely. It's Catholics. It's groups that are seen as out-groups then, who are indeed immigrating in large numbers to the country, but it's not perhaps the same groups that people talk about today when immigration is part of the political discourse. And family background and immigration background is really important to Pelley personally. Tell me about how genealogy and this idea of white ancestry plays into Pelley's views of himself.
Yes, it was very important to be able to demonstrate the white lineage and Protestant native-born lineage that he possesses, that he expected from his followers. And Pelley, I think, viewed himself as a descendant of the sort of founding generations that he ascribed values to that maybe not weren't necessarily the values they actually had. But to him, they were reflections of these traditional, quote unquote, American values that he wanted to make clear he possessed, and therefore he had the moral ground to make these claims and to try to differentiate between different groups of Americans, particularly those who he didn't think truly should be Americans.
And what's so interesting about that, Pelley's idea of having to prove your racial identity before you can be a part of even a political movement, very much in line with the racism developing in Nazi Germany a few decades later in the 1930s.
Absolutely.
One thing that strikes me that you make this point very clearly in your book is that Pelley has an incredible work ethic throughout his life. Tell us about Pelley's sort of work ethic as a young man and how that carries out throughout his career.
Right. I think that it ties into, in some ways, what Pelley viewed as this traditional Protestant work ethic going back to the Puritans. And from a very young age, he has his first magazine when he's 12 years old. He is working for his father in the printing press when his father was a newspaper editor. And I think it ties into his overarching drive to be successful and to make a name for himself, that he recognized that if he would continue to work hard and continue to publish as much as possible, that would help get his name out there and help establish him as a significant figure, whether that be politically or religiously. And so he was an incredibly hardworking guy.
So I certainly was not writing for a press that I owned at the age of 12 years old. I doubt many of our listeners were. So the young Pelley, I think he's a savant in some ways. And probably unsurprisingly, he becomes a writer.
Right. His career starts to take off once he begins writing short stories along with working for newspapers. And the short stories are really an attempt for him to recreate a lost world, a golden age that he thinks we have lost because of immigration, because of the Jewish influence in the United States. And the stories are very successful. They're turgid and maudlin by modern standards, but they were works that resonated with sort of a middle-class audience in the 19-teens and in the 1920s. And so there were a lot of folks who also hearkened back to this prior age where they viewed America as being what they thought America should be. And a lot of folks identified, I think, with the sort of message that Pelley was sending because it did give them this idea of what things used to be like, even if they aren't still like that today.
Yeah, one fascinating thing is that everyone thinks the good old days are sometime in the past, no matter when you live, right? People now look at the 1950s as the good old days. Mm-hmm. In this period, they're looking at the 1850s, depending on where they are.
Yes.
So by the 1910s, he is running a couple of newspapers, he is contributing, he's writing on a really steady pace here, and he seems to be doing fairly well, but the newspaper business itself is not doing terribly well, which is something we forget.
Right.
The press has always been up and down business in the United States. And so Pelley, by the 1910s, certainly begins moving more into the fiction world. What really drives that choice? Do you think it's his changing interests, or is it simply the finances?
I think to a large degree it was financial. I also think he felt at a certain level he was stifled by being a New England newspaper editor. That wasn't going to make him a famous and significant figure, and he had to find another outlet. And writing fiction, to him, it seems like the logical course to take if he's going to become a prominent American figure.
It's a great point, and I think he has almost delusions of grandeur here to some extent throughout his career. But in this early stage, it seems like he wants to be the next great American novelist or something along those lines. Do you agree with that, or where do you think the ambitions really go?
Yeah, absolutely. I think his goal all along was to be famous and a celebrity of some sort. And at that stage of his life, the logical path for him in his mind was to be a short story writer who then transitions into a novelist, which he did very successfully. I think that was a stepping stone in many ways towards what comes later, but it's reflective of that overarching desire of his to be a person of prominence and for the rest of the country to recognize what an important figure he really is.
Right now, our listeners might be wondering why we're talking about a short story author, effectively on a podcast about fascism. But that transition, this background is really important to the transition that comes later. I think one of the inflection points, maybe one of two inflection points, we can decide whether we agree on what they are here, is when he actually goes off to Japan and then Siberia during World War I. And our audience has to remember here that Pelley and his wife actually make this journey during the war itself. A lot of people don't remember that Japan was actually on the Allied side of World War I. So why does Pelley go to Japan, number one? Number two, why does he end up in Siberia?
Sure. So initially he goes to Japan, or goes to Asia, as the reporter for the Methodist Centenary. It was the 100-year anniversary of American Methodist sending missionaries into the Pacific. And they wanted to send some speakers over there, to send some ministers over there. And they wanted someone to document those trips. Pelley's short fiction, again, gaining enough attention that folks recognize him as a name and potentially someone who would be interested in doing this because he was a journalist along with being a short story writer. His values seemed to correspond with what they wanted. His father had been a Methodist minister. And so the Methodist Centenary contracts with him to go to Japan initially to cover this. And it's once he's in Japan, he runs into or is contacted by some folks who are involved with the YMCA over there. And they then ask him to go onto the mainland to cover some of the things that are happening with YMC operations in Siberia, in eastern Russia at that point. And so he gets caught up in the middle of a lot of that fighting. He sees a lot of the destruction that has occurred. He sees a lot of the suffering that is occurring because of that civil war. And for Pelley, all of those things are laid at the feet of the Reds. And communism immediately becomes a real bogeyman for him. Communism at that point was already being limbed as something that's anti-American. And for Pelley, he directly links communism to Judaism. And so for him, communists become the enemy and Jews become the enemy in part because Jews are communists.
This is a very common conflation we see among anti-Semites later on, that communism is a Jewish phenomenon and allegedly being brought to the U.S. by Jewish immigrants during the 1930s, which then again brings in this anti-immigration sentiment. So Pelley comes back and finds his newspaper business in disarray. But Pelley quickly finds himself with a new opportunity. And I think it's an opportunity that I compare in some ways to the technology industry in the 1990s and early 2000s, and that is Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Hollywood is a brand new idea, really, in the 1910s. The 1920s is when Hollywood is really going to take off and become the modern business behemoth that we know it today as. How the heck does Pelley make his way from being a YMCA volunteer in Siberia and a newspaper editor to writing Hollywood screenplays?
Pelley gets involved in the film industry on the East Coast in New York and New Jersey because some folks saw some of his short stories. They were always looking for stories for the early films. And so when motion pictures then moved to California, Pelley, I think at that point, probably believed that the motion picture industry was going to be the way he was going to establish himself as a prominent figure, that this was a way to augment his writing career by having motion pictures made out of his stories and books. And so he follows the film industry to Hollywood in a very direct way. And once out there, establishes himself very quickly as a successful screenwriter. And because he was so prolific and was always writing, he's cranking out scripts for these movies. And so he's a very popular screenwriter because of the fact that he can whip up a script in no time and get it out there.
So Pelley really has some pretty big time contacts in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. He's making quite a good deal of money. Who are the big friends that he's got in Hollywood that are helping his career along?
Lon Chaney Sr. is probably the most famous today. Chaney becomes sort of his primary conduit into the sort of central world of Hollywood because Chaney was such a big star himself already. And they seem to hit it off quite nicely. They and their wives hang out together. They go out to dinner a lot and that sort of thing. And so Chaney really gives him a leg into Hollywood that he might not have had necessarily if he had just been another one of these guys who's cranking out screenplays for the programmers of the 1920s.
So I think it's fair to say that Pelley is pretty successful in the Hollywood of the 1920s. He's written a number of films. He has big name friends. He has an agent. But by 1928, he basically proclaims that he's burnt out. You quote in your book saying that he begins to adopt a more anti-Semitic attitude towards Jews in Hollywood, saying that they are, quote, ignorant and uncultured, according to Pelley. And then he also talks about himself wanting to, quote, extricate himself from the flesh pots of Hollywood. Which I believe is a direct quote from him himself.
Yes.
What's happened here?
I think there's a point where the traditionalist mind in Pelly is, in a sense, in the belly of the beast in Hollywood. Most of the studio heads are Jewish. A lot of the actors and other writers in particular are Jewish. And Hollywood, by the late 1920s, had already gained a reputation as a place that was pretty freewheeling, and a lot of crazy parties and such was going on. And maybe the values and morals of Hollywood didn't necessarily mesh with the values and morals of the United States. And I think there's a point where Pelly becomes convinced that if he is surrounded by these folks, that he is going to be led into the sort of temptation that he sees around him, and that what Hollywood is producing doesn't represent the sort of values that he holds, and that in many ways are antithetical to the values that he thinks America should hold. I think in some ways it echoes the Puritan arguments about that if you are surrounded by any sort of evil, you're going to be corrupted by that evil, and therefore you have to extricate yourself from all evil.
One thing I think our listeners should remember here, this is the Prohibition era.
Yes.
Literally, alcohol is illegal. I don't think they were observing that so much in Hollywood.
No.
There's many books you can read about the freewheeling lifestyles that are being led there. And we should note that Pelly himself is either a teetotaler or drinks minimally. So this lifestyle, in many ways, I think doesn't appeal to him for exactly the reasons you say. Very much this idea of being surrounded by iniquity, being surrounded
yes.
by temptation is a way for one to lose one's soul. William Dudley Pelly is about to have a spiritual experience that's going to change his perspective on life and the universe forever. When we come back, we'll talk about Pelly's alleged encounter with the divine that ultimately put him on the path to his own brand of American fascism. So Pelly is 38 years old at this point, still a young man, and something really profound happens to him on the night of May 28th, 1928. Pelly has a unique experience that he calls his, quote, 7 minutes in eternity. What happens on this night? What does Pelly say?
According to Pelly, it was late at night. He was drifting off to sleep, and he suddenly was transported to a different plane of existence. He had a narrator who walks him through this because he's very nervous about what's happening to him, and he's told to calm down. We're giving you a message here. And what the messenger then shows him are these other planes that are higher planes of existence, and explains to Pelly that this is a byproduct of reincarnation, that life on Earth is a proving ground and an educational experience for every soul, and that as you gain more knowledge, eventually you're able to leave this plane and move into these higher planes of existence, and that this is the goal that he needs to undertake for his own soul. And so he's transported, and when he then comes back, they make clear to him that he's going to be the recipient of knowledge and information and messages that will be channeled to him from those higher planes of existence for him to use this as a way to instruct other folks on what their spiritual growth needs to be. After this, he just totally throws himself into it. The 7 minutes in eternity is written up in American Magazine later that year. He gets thousands of letters from folks who are intrigued by what he has written about. And I think that's at the point where he figures out maybe this is the way. Now I can write about religion and spiritualism instead of writing the sort of short stories and screenplays that I had before, that maybe this is the path forward for him. And I think one thing we keep in mind is that not only is he burnt out in Hollywood by that point, but his fiction writing career is pretty much ground to a halt. And so the 7 minutes in eternity sets up the second half of his life because it does pivot him toward religion and spiritualism, which hadn't necessarily been things he wrote very much about before this.
And we have to remember that spiritualism was a very popular movement in the 1920s, not only in the U.S., but in Great Britain as well. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, for instance, the author of Sherlock Holmes, turns his attention to spiritualism.
Sure.
And this was a movement especially for people who had lost relatives in World War I. In Britain, there were hundreds of thousands of young men, husbands and sons, who had been killed. And this idea that you could contact the dead from beyond the grave has some obvious appeal, really. One thing that strikes me about the 7 minutes in eternity, though, is that Pelly claims to meet people on this separate spiritual plane that he had known in life.
Yes.
And are now have been deceased. That's a very unchristian idea in traditional Christian theology. Yes. How does Pelley jive, for lack of a better term, his Methodism and his upbringing with this spiritual revelation he's had?
It's an interesting twist. I don't think he ever really gave up the values that he developed as a young conservative Methodist boy in New England. I think what changes, though, is that he is increasingly convinced that Christianity itself has been corrupted and perverted, and that there is a path that is outside of the scriptures that has not been affected by, as he would claim, by the Jews who have rewritten the story of Christ and have altered it to make it more amenable to their beliefs and to make them more sympathetic in some ways, trying to figure out that if there's a path forward to remain a Christian, but do it in a way that you could eliminate some of the Jewish influence. And really, the only way you can do that is if you're going to abandon the New Testament altogether and just claim that you're getting messages and that the story itself is not what you think it is. And he's going to provide the actual story of Christ and the actual story of what happens with souls after death.
So in the 7 minutes to eternity, he says that when these people who have taken him to this higher plane, whatever that may mean, return him, he comes back with certain skills. One of which is that he sees himself as a radio set. This is the term he uses that can tune in to voices from the beyond. But he also claims to have the ability to engage in things like automatic writing.
Yes.
What's the full range of Pelley's supposed skills here? And what's the unique significance, do you think, of the automatic writing stuff? That really strikes me as something that probably our listeners aren't familiar with, but it was something very popular in the 1920s.
Automatic writing was one of the sort of central parts of spiritualism in the 1920s. And there were a lot of folks who claimed to be automatic writers, that they were channeling messages, that they were going directly from some higher plane to their hand, and they had no input whatsoever in what's being written. And so therefore, these messages have a certain level of validity because they're not being interpreted by the person who is channeling them. And Pelley would sometimes refer to himself as the recorder because he is the guy who is recording these messages from higher planes.
Pelley talks about needing to castigate what he calls these dark souls from traditional Christianity. And you've alluded to Jews as being one of these corruptors of Christianity, but it applies to Catholics as well.
Yes. He was very anti-Catholic. I suspect a lot of that derives from his childhood in New England, where he sees all of the new immigrants coming in who were overwhelmingly Catholic, and the sort of nativist resentment about Catholics, which is a long-lived idea in American history. We inherit from the English an anti-Catholic sentiment that the Irish ran into the same thing in the 1840s, that because they're Catholic, they may not be assimilatable into the United States. And so I think that the Catholic criticisms probably come from those older ideas within him, but it's certainly true that the dark souls weren't all Jews to start with. And it's over the course of the next few years that those dark souls absolutely just become Jews.
This might be a hard question, but I think it's one that our listeners are probably asking themselves. Do you think he really believed this? Does he believe that he has tapped into this? Or how much of this is him thinking about the next business opportunity?
That is a really hard question. I'm willing to give him credit that he probably believed most of these things he was saying, but I also think that we need to temper that with the fact that he was desperately trying to be famous and a celebrity, and adopting spiritualism is part of that drive. And it's, I think, he views as an avenue toward that sort of success, which probably does propel him towards writing a lot more stuff than he necessarily would have.
But I think regardless, it's a shrewd move, much
yes.
as getting into Hollywood in, let's say, the early 1920s is a shrewd move. Spiritualism in 1928 is approaching its zenith in
yes.
the U.S. This is a movement that will very rapidly begin declining in the 1930s when people don't really have the money for this type
right.
of thing anymore. But in the late 1920s, this is big business. And Pelley, of course, profits from this spiritual transition in very material ways. One of the accounts I read recently is of him doing an automatic writing exercise with an elderly woman where he's holding her hand and she puts her head back and he says, "I'm not doing any writing. I'm just holding her wrist and the pencil is writing for itself."
Yes.
But it reaps some very rapid rewards for him. So he talks about women sending him checks to further his work. He basically starts a journal that is related to his spiritualist undertakings. He starts a university. You could actually attend a university called Galahad University and pay tuition to learn about spiritual abilities and presumably try to move up within that spiritual system that he has discovered. But there's another important material factor that happens here, which is that he moves to Asheville, North Carolina in this period.
Yes.
Now, Asheville, North Carolina is not perhaps an expected place for a man who's grown up in New England. He's spent a bunch of time in Hollywood. Why Asheville, North Carolina?
Asheville has always had a reputation as being a pretty liberal, wide-open sort of town, open to different sorts of ideas. And there was a lot of spiritualism going on in Asheville. And so he's offered some land down there. He's offered an opportunity to establish his college. And for Pelley, it seems like the most reasonable place for him to go because he would have been, I think, in his mind, more of a sort of a big fish in a small pond in Asheville versus just another one of these automatic writers in Manhattan when they were a dime a dozen. The sort of drawing room spiritualism was everywhere at that point. And so in some ways, it's putting him in the center of a spiritualist center, but not a heavily populated spiritualist center. So it gives him that opportunity to make himself a more prominent figure.
You alluded to Pelley making the move towards politics, which he really begins to do by the early 1930s. But before he really founds the Silver Legion, the group that we're primarily talking about in this podcast, he comes up with this idea of the Commonwealth Economic System,
yes,
what he'll later on refer to as the Christian Commonwealth. This is an interesting mix of anti-Semitism, racism, heterodox economics to some extent, as well as this kind of form of Christianity that he has developed.
Yes. So under the Christian Commonwealth, all white residents would be stockholders in the Commonwealth, that was effectively the government and all business. Business would be centrally organized and operated, which is an interesting part of this because you're skirting communism there very closely, but he didn't really seem to pick up on that. And so all white residents owned stock in the corporation. And as businesses made money, the stock was effectively in not just the government and the country, but in the businesses. The profitability of the businesses would then translate into income for the stockholders. And those who were in prominent positions would have more stock. Those who were custodians and alike would have less stock. And tied into that stock and performing particular duties for the Commonwealth would also be realty stock that would allow you then to buy homes and to move up in terms of your housing, which also looks a lot like what the Soviet Union did at the same time. The white residents owned stock. And for Pelley, one of the arguments is that guaranteed income of owning stock would allow folks to focus more attention on their spiritual growth rather than just trying to make money. And it also would provide a sort of basic income for those who wanted to pursue art of some sort because they didn't have to worry about an income and could therefore go after their artistic pursuits. If you were not a white member of society, however, you were not going to get stock. You were effectively chattel laborers if you were black. If you were Jewish, you would be ghettoized into one city per state that would be overrun by the Department of Jewry, which would then keep an eye on what those folks were doing. And he never really fully explains what happens in those ghettos and how those folks survive. That Commonwealth would be governed by a small group of folks who were the elite, and not all that shockingly, Pelley was viewed himself as the guy who would be able to implement this and run this. And then you've add a veneer of religion on top of that. So it's a theocratic anti-Semitic corporatism in that his expectation was that his religious beliefs would then also be part of the foundation of that society and that it would be a perfected community in preparation for the return of Christ, who would then come back and run that Christian Commonwealth after his return.
I think a lot of our listeners are probably like mind-boggled right now of how wild these ideas sound, right? And Pelley gives himself this unique title of the chief.
He's the chief.
Which is not dissimilar from the Duce,
yes,
Benito Mussolini's title. So he's really melding his spiritualism in with this kind of nascent political movement that he's talking and writing about already in public. But then everything changes for Pelley. Certainly his political awakening, he claims, comes on January 30th, 1933,
right,
which is the date when Adolf Hitler becomes the Chancellor of Germany.
Hitler! Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil!
And I cite something in my book that I found interesting where Pelley claims to have at that point received a vision from Jesus or he hears something audibly. It's not really clear to me which. I think probably more,
yes,
audible in a seance setting. that when a painter takes control of Germany, that he's to found a new political movement. And of course, yes. Hitler has been a painter in the past. And so Pelli, supposedly, the day after Hitler becomes Chancellor of Germany, creates this new political movement called the Silver Legion, aka yes. the Silver Shirts. It goes by a bunch of different names, yes. actually, all over the country, partially because it has a bunch of incorporated companies all over the yeah. country that are actually its legal entity. What is the connection between the Silver Legion and Nazism, and why silver?
Part of his adoption of Hitler is, yes, he receives this channeled message. The other part of it is that he also believed in pyramidism, that the Great Pyramid in Egypt has a timeline that you could map out events in human history. And so there are pyramid dates along the pyramid timeline. And Hitler's ascension corresponds to one of those pyramid dates. And he receives this message. And so that convinces him absolutely that he needs to come out in open support with Adolf Hitler. And silver ends up as the color for his shirts, I think simply because it was one of the colors that was available, right? I mean, we already have black shirts, we have brown shirts, we're going to have khaki shirts, we're going to have all these different colored shirts among American Nazi organizations in the 1930s.
And you also have the gold shirts in Mexico.
And the gold shirts in Mexico,
too. So
yes.
really, the color spectrum is fairly yes. cornered by extremist yes. movements in this period already.
Sure.
But you mentioned these uniforms that Pelli mandates yes. for all of the members of the Silver Legion. We'll talk about how many people join this kind of outlandish-sounding group in a moment here. But the uniform is silver. It has dark trousers.
Yeah, blue trousers.
Blue trousers. But a very distinctive illustration on the left breast, right yes. over the heart, which is a scarlet L.
Yes.
And the scarlet L has particular meanings, and it's really the most important part of the uniform, this L.
The L stands for love, loyalty, and liberation. And to him, those were sort of the three tenets of what the Silver Shirt Legion was about. And that also then helps him connect the Silver Shirts to his spiritualist movement and his sort of burgeoning religious movement, which is going to be at least initially called liberation and liberation doctrine. And so he's able to connect the political with the religious in a very direct way with the Silver Shirt Legion. They also would have a tie that would have their membership number on it, which is an important part of the uniform, so you know exactly who was a member. And again, if you were going to be a member of the Silver Shirt Legion, you had to be of certain racial stock, and you had to be able to back up that. You had to be willing to pay the annual dues, which I want to say was like $10 a year. You had to buy a uniform from him. In many ways, the way that he organizes the Silver Shirt Legion and the way that he sets it up so that he can make some money off of these things looks a lot like what the second or new KKK did in the 1920s.
But the religious aspect of this is really intriguing. And at one point, Pelli says, quote, "Our second Christ will be a dictator." And he sees this religious aspect that we certainly don't see in National Socialism. Hitler has a very fractious relationship with organized religion and wants to elevate the Nazi Party above all forms of religion, basically. What does Pelli mean when he says our second Christ will be a dictator? And does he see fascism as God's plan for him and for the country?
I think so. I think that for him, we should be clear that for him, fascism needs to be viewed as revolving around the Christian Commonwealth idea. And for him, that was, in a large extent, not just an economic plan, but it was a process of creating a theocratic state based upon his beliefs. And so for him, the return of Christ is that Christ is truly going to rule and Christ is going to dictate. And there's going to be a society that revolves around the teachings of Christ as filtered through the recorder / the chief / William Dudley Pelli. And I think for him, part of that idea of a dictator comes out of that belief that the Commonwealth is going to be created first. And so, therefore, there's going to be an environment where Christ can truly rule on earth because there will be no opposition, because everyone will have bought into the Commonwealth and become part of this Commonwealth. And therefore, we're going to have a different sort of rule than perhaps a lot of Christians think about with the return of Christ. For him, it always was revolving around the United States. And I think he viewed the United States as the place where Christ was probably going to return and that this is where Christ is going to rule earth from. There's a reason he gets called the Star-Spangled Fascist sometimes, because he was very patriotic in his own strange way. And so I think that's what he meant primarily by Christ as a dictator, is that he's going to be in charge of the Commonwealth and the Commonwealth's going to be running everything.
Let's talk about the structure of the Silver Legion for a moment. So our listeners who have heard our episodes on the Bund know that there was a main membership cohort within the German-American Bund. There were also sort of sympathizer members. You, in theory, had to become a sympathizer and pay some money that way and then become a full-on member. And if you were really hardcore, you could join the Stormtrooper Division, what was called the OD in the Bund. Pelley's structure is somewhat similar. Is this explicitly based upon what Hitler has done with the SA and the SS? What are these guys planning for? Why is there an armed division really at all?
Yeah, I think it's probably a little bit of both in terms of inspiration from what was going on in Europe, coupled with this is just the sort of natural way you would structure an autocratic paramilitary organization, that you have to have someone in top, you have to have folks who are assigned particular leadership roles, and then you filter it down to state-level organizations and then community-level organizations. The Silver Legion itself had different types of cells within it. One of the groups that is the one that gets in the most trouble are the groups that sort of get labeled actionists. And these are the guys who are street thugs who are going to hold violent protests. He viewed it as an essential part of defending himself. I also think it's important for him to send that sort of message or create that sort of image of strength, that he has these forces marshaled behind him who are ready to follow him into battle.
The Silver Legion is actually about to become a paramilitary organization. Its supporters and its leaders will start stockpiling weapons, waiting for the American Revolution that will supposedly sweep William Dudley Pelley into power. And Pelley himself isn't going to be shy about his ambitions to become an American dictator, by force, if necessary.
He's a tough guy. He's got a bunch of tough guys behind him, and he's ready to fight if that's what it takes to accomplish his aims.
Our special thanks to Scott Beekman, author of the book William Dudley Pelley, A Life in Right-Wing Extremism and the Occult. This program was edited by Brian Fantinelli, mixed and mastered by Joseph Powers, and executive produced by Brendan Gokel. Be sure to subscribe to the Star-Spangled Fascism podcast wherever you get your podcasts, on our YouTube page, and follow us now on social media. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at DrBWHart. I'll be posting previews from our upcoming episodes there, and feel free to leave your comments. If you have a question about the podcast, email us at questions@starspangledfascismpodcast.com. I'm Bradley W. Hart. Thank you for listening.